Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Anstie Harris, who lives by the seaside in a house full of violins with her husband, a violin maker. There is a double bass in her dining room and a row of violins hanging above the spare bed. She teaches creative writing and runs Writing Matters. Her novel, The Truth and Triumphs of Grace Atherton, recently won the Sapere Books Popular Romantic Fiction Award at the RNA Awards. In the book, Grace teaches us that love in all forms is friendship set to music. Also with us this evening is Natasha Lester, who worked as a marketing executive for L'Oreal, managing the Maybelline brand, before returning to university to study creative writing. Her latest novel, The French Photographer, recently won the Goldsborough Books Historical Romantic Novel Award at the RNA Awards. It is set both in 1942 in war-torn Paris and more recently in 2005. Also joined by Patricia Wilson, who was born in Liverpool, has lived on Crete and is now settled on Rhodes. She was first inspired to write when she unearthed a rusted machine gun in her garden, one used in the events that unfolded during World War II on the island of Crete. The now elderly woman involved told Patricia her story, and her debut, Island of Secrets, was the result. Her latest novel, Greek Island Escape, is about a woman who is searching for her daughter. And finally on tonight's book show is Mark Jarvis. He's been a primary teacher for 26 years. His debut children's book, Ned and the Chocolate Treats, is based on Mark's real-life companion, his dog, Ned. Mark has created a world where many animals can talk and where an exuberant Jack Russell and his person race across the world in an adventure of a lifetime. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
I am unwritten, can't read my mind, I'm undefined. I'm just beginning, the pen's in my hand. Before you open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Treat yourself in words unspoken. Live your
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Anstie Harris, who lives by the seaside in a house full of violins with her husband, a violin maker. There is a double bass in her dining room and a row of violins hanging above the spare bed. When she began typing what became The Truths and Triumphs of Grace Atherton and looked up to see a cellist practicing in the window of the house opposite, she knew the book she had to write. She is the recent winner of the Sapere Books Popular Romantic Fiction Award at the Romantic Novelists Association Award Ceremony, and it's for the most commercially successful and popular romantic novel of 2019, as voted for by book bloggers, librarians and booksellers. Welcome to the book show, Anstie.
Hi, nice to be here. It's funny that you should do that introduction, because at this exact moment my husband is downstairs. I'm upstairs in my office and he's downstairs having a violin lesson with his violin tutor through an app online.
Oh, how wonderful.
So I've also got a background of English folk tunes.
Oh, nice. Well, it could be a worse background, couldn't it?
Definitely. Mind you haven't heard him play.
So violins and music has always been a big part of your life, but interestingly, you're not really a musician yourself.
I'm not. That's an interesting question. I'm a very good singer, and I'm not kind of shy about that. I like singing, and I believe I'm good at it. But I just fail to master stringed instruments. I've tried and tried. I started playing the cello when I was 11, and I'm 55 this year, and I've still not got past grade 2, which, you know, kind of quite a lot of 8-year-olds have.
And why do you think that is, then?
It's funny, I was just having this conversation with my daughter yesterday, who's using her isolation to, for her and her daughter, who's just turned 2, to nail their violin skills. And it's because I think what makes it easy to learn an instrument is to not be afraid, to understand that it's fine to make mistakes and just carry on. And I think when I was talking to my daughter about this yesterday, I said it's very similar to learning a language. That if you're learning a language and you are quite prepared to speak that language to native speakers, and if you get it wrong, you get it wrong. You don't care. You learn your lesson, and you the next time you say it properly. I'm quite happy to do that, and I'm very confident speaking other languages. But I'm not confident in making those mistakes with music. And when I hear that it's wrong, I immediately think, oh no, it's wrong. I can't do it. And no amount of talking myself out of that will work.
Oh, that's interesting. So how about your writing background? Because I understand you teach creative writing and also have your own company, Writing Matters.
I do. I think, to be honest, it's very much the same set of skills. Good writers are simple writers. They write sparingly and elegantly, and they do that by not worrying about whether the word they put there was the right word. They put the word there that's instinctive, and they can always go back and change it. Just like if you use the wrong tense when you're speaking in Spanish, or if you got a note wrong when you were learning the violin, it's all about trusting yourself to be able to do these things. And then the more you can kind of let go of trying too hard, the easier it is, I believe, to write well. And certainly that's the experience of my students.
It must be fun to see people evolving as writers, you know, who maybe weren't so great at the beginning, and then through learning more and reading and writing more, becoming accomplished writers.
Literally. And it's and the funny thing is that I've kind of learned and observed over the years, although it happens gradually, obviously it happens gradually as people become more confident and more skilled, but there is always a day, just one moment, where suddenly that person writes something and it's beautiful, and they've been struggling and trying and really, you know, it's been really hard for them, and then just one day it just clicks and they've got it. And it's such an amazing thing to see, and a privilege to be part of if you're teaching.
And is it the kind of thing that once you have that moment, you've got it, and you kind of always have it, and you kind of know the skills, you know the tricks, all that kind of thing? Or is it something that you believe always needs to be worked on, and you're only as good as the last thing you wrote?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. I believe there are things we need. One of the things that writers need is resilience. An awful lot of writing is about being rejected, and you need, or being corrected, which is something you have to learn to accept. And also, I, funnily enough, just was talking to my students last night. We had an online class. We were talking about resilience in writing when you're faced with something like we are now, where we're all indoors and we're on lockdown, and everybody's saying online, well, this is the time to write, when Shakespeare was holed up for the great plague, he wrote Jaws 2 and similar memes. But it's hard to write when you're nervous. It's hard to write when you're insecure. So actually, it's about learning to carve that space mentally, whether you're facing a crisis or whether you're just trying to pick yourself up from some rejection, or whether you feel, do you know what, I've been writing this thing for 4 years and still nobody's telling me that it's a winner. You have to pick yourself up from that and carve yourself some safe space where you can accept all of those things around you and then go into this space and write. And it's a challenge. It's difficult, especially at a time like now. But they're the same set of skills that you need when people are constantly saying to you, yes, we love your writing, but it's not quite right for us.
Mm.
Do try again. And it's the trying again that will lead to your success. The only novel that you are guaranteed never to sell is the one you either haven't written or have never shown to anybody.
Yes, no, absolutely.
And I can promise you won't sell that.
So looking at your book then, The Truths and Triumphs of Grace Atherton, tell us about Grace.
Grace is, kind of to my mind, Grace is every woman. It's very much a novel about women, about women's relationships with each other and about women's relationships looking outwards at the world, at society and our place in that. Having said that, it is also a very good novel for men to read too, I have been told. Grace is a kind of product, well, as we all are, Grace is a product of her own story. And this book is about her coming to terms, as the title tells you, with her own truths and attempting to turn those into a triumph in the face of adversity.
So how does music and the violin feature in the book?
Grace is a violin maker. She had originally intended to be a professional musician, a concert cellist, but she was sent away from the conservatoire that she'd won a place at and can't play the cello anymore. She can still play, but she can't play in front of anybody because the memories are just too painful. So instead she trained to become a luthier, a violin maker, and so she is surrounded all the time by instruments, making them, playing them, and all the people that she meets are connected, most of the people she meets are connected to instruments. And this story is about three people who are very different, but who are brought together by the fact that they all play, in this case, cello and violin.
Okay. And her partner of 8 years, David, he's prominent in the story.
He's very prominent in the story. I don't know how much you want me to say about David because of spoilers.
Well, tell us a bit without kind of harming the story.
David is himself very conflicted. He's brought to his adult life the products of his own childhood, and that causes him to not always behave in a way, or so it appears, causes him to not always behave in the best way possible. And he and Grace he lives in a loveless marriage, and he and Grace have been holding on for David to be able to leave his wife when his children are old enough. The book begins in the Paris metro, where there's an accident and a woman falls in front of a train, and David is the only person there who dives off the platform onto the track in front of a train and pulls the woman to safety. The CCTV footage from the station sparks off an international hunt for the mystery hero who has done this, which sheds unwelcome light on David and Grace's relationship. And then the rest of the story is really a combination of kind of music and violin making, travel. The book takes place, a lot of the action, the second half of the book really takes place in Cremona in northern Italy, which is where Stradivari was born and kind of the home of violin making.
Okay.
Well, not kind of, it's definitely the home of violin making across the globe. And it also takes place in Paris and in Kent, where I live.
Oh, nice. So the fact that it's all about something that you're passionate about, it must have been great to write the book, an enjoyable experience, was it?
Definitely. I mean, writing a book is very much a team effort. Without the input of your agent and without the input of your editor, you really wouldn't get anywhere. And so when I first gave this book to my agent, it had a big slice about a an orchestra that was for people with dementia who had forgotten or were unable to access most information but could still play their instruments. And sadly, that was taken out, not sadly, because it did make it a better book. It focused on the actual story. But when the book became a Richard and Judy pick, at that point, you're allowed to put back in chapters at the back of the book that have been deleted, because everybody has them. And so I got to put my orchestra in, after all, in the back of the Richard and Judy. And then when it went to my editor at Simon & Schuster, who is very talented, she realised that it contained too much technical information about making violins. And so she literally carved away some of that technical information. And there is still a significant amount about the structure of a violin and how it's actually physically made from a plank of wood or chunk of tree, but not unnecessarily so.
Interesting. And I have to ask you about the award, winning the Sapiri Books Popular Romantic Fiction Award. A great thing to win an award voted for by book bloggers, librarians and booksellers, no?
Unbelievable. And because the fabulous thing about the RNA Awards is that it's not based on kind of how much a book is promoted or anything else, because it's marketed. It's chosen by those people on the chalk face of reading, and it's such a privilege and really wonderful. And also, because the people that I was in the group with, the finalists in my group were Beth O'Leary, Heidi Swain, and Iona Gray. And all three of them are unbelievable writers as well as lovely people. And so I had absolutely no idea that I would win. And I wasn't kind of being disingenuous. I just had no idea at all that I would win. And so it was just great. Absolutely fantastic.
Oh, wonderful. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Truths and Triumphs of Grace Atherton, it is out now and available to buy on our website on tre.radio in the bookshop section. And it's by Anstey Harris, who we've been chatting to today. Anstey, I have to say, before we say goodbye, I know you're the mother of singer-songwriter Lucy Spraggan. I think she's great.
Oh, great. Thank you.
I play her songs on my show sometimes, so I'll give you a mention next time I play her.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, she'd like that.
Brilliant.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Bye-bye.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from Australia is Natasha Lester, who worked as a marketing executive for L'Oreal, managing the Maybelline brand, before returning to university to study creative writing. She's written several novels, including A Kiss from Mr. Fitzgerald, Her Mother's Secret, and The Paris Seamstress. In her spare time, Natasha loves to teach writing. She's with us on The Book Show to talk about her latest novel, The French Photographer. Welcome to The Book Show, Natasha.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And before we talk about books and writing, I'm really interested to ask you about your time working with L'Oreal and Maybelline. Must have been exciting, was it?
Oh, it was. It was every woman's dream job to have in her 20s, which is when I worked there, because I had a bathroom cupboard full of more lipsticks than any could ever wear in an entire lifetime. And it was just a really fun and exciting job. I loved marketing anyway. And then to land in a company where, you know, it was like playing all day long was even more fun. So I was very lucky to have that job, and I enjoyed it a lot. And got to practice my French speaking skills as well, which was great too. So yeah, it was the perfect job for me.
So what made you stop that, come away from that industry and go back to uni to study creative writing?
Well, the job that I had with L'Oreal was, I live in Perth in Australia, which is on the western side of the country, and the job that I had in L'Oreal was over in Melbourne, which is on the eastern side of the country. And so my husband had followed me across to Melbourne when I got that job, and then he had to come back to Perth for his work. And as he had followed me across the country for mine, it seemed only fair that I follow him back across the country for his job. So I had to quit L'Oreal, which was quite sad. And then coming back to Perth, most companies don't have their head offices in Perth. They're mostly in Melbourne and Sydney. So I knew that I wasn't going to find the same kind of job back in my hometown as I had had. And I thought, well, rather than get a job that will never be quite as good as what I'd had and kind of be disappointed, perhaps it was time to do something else. I'd always wanted to do writing, but when I had left high school, there weren't creative writing degrees at universities, so there wasn't really a way to become a writer. But by the time I left L'Oreal, the universities did have creative writing degrees, and so I thought, well, maybe I'll give that a try to find out if this thing that I've always thought that I wanted to do is actually something that I really would enjoy doing. So went back to uni, did my degree in creative writing, loved it, and haven't looked back since.
Oh, fantastic. And what was it like going back to university?
It was actually great. I think that if you go back when you're a little bit older, so I was around 30 when I went back, which seems actually young now, but you go back because you want to be there, and so you tend to go to all of the classes and attend all of the lectures and do all of the readings and ask questions because you want to be there, you're interested, you're engaged in the learning. So it's a much, much better experience, I think, than going to university as an 18-year-old when, you know, all you're really interested in doing is going out with your friends. So
yeah.
Despite the fact that I was older than most of the students there, I actually really enjoyed it and became really quite good friends with quite a few of my teachers, and I'm still in touch with them today.
Oh, lovely. That's great. So did you know, or how did you find out what kind of author you wanted to be, the sort of books that you wanted to write?
It did take me a few years to figure that out. I think because I wrote my very first book, which wasn't a historical novel, it was more of a contemporary literary novel, as part of my university master's thesis. And so when you write a book as a thesis, there's an expectation about the type of book you'll write. It needs to be quite serious and weighty and sort of live up to university standards, I suppose. And so I wrote that because I was in that environment. Then I wrote another novel very similar to that first book. And then I wrote yet another one in the same kind of vein and really didn't enjoy that writing process. It wasn't fun. I wasn't enjoying it. I didn't want to write something so serious and grim almost. So I ended up throwing that third book in the bin and taking all of the books I loved off my bookshelf, reading all those, realising that I loved reading historical fiction of all things, and thought, well, why don't I actually write that, write what I wanted to write rather than write what I thought that I should write, which is what I had been doing until that point. So then I started writing historical fiction, and immediately I started doing that, I fell back in love with writing and knew I'd found what I was meant to do.
Yeah, fantastic. So looking at the new book, it's called The French Photographer. Tell us about some of the main characters.
So the main character in The French Photographer is Jessica May, and she is inspired by a woman called Lee Miller, who was a photojournalist for Vogue working out of Europe during the Second World War. And Lee photographed some quite extraordinary things during war, and she was an incredible woman. And when I first read about her, I knew that I wanted to write a character inspired by Lee's wonderful work during the war and her incredible bravery. So Jess is based on her. Also appearing in the novel are other female photojournalists from that time. Although it's a novel, I do love to draw on real events and real people. So Martha Gellhorn, who was also a brilliant foreign correspondent and who is sometimes more widely known as one of Ernest Hemingway's wives, also appears in the novel and is one of Jess's good friends. In the novel, there's also a paratrooper called Dan Haworth who gives Jess a bit of a hand as she finds it quite tricky to navigate some of the male perceptions of women near the front line. And again, a girl called Victorine is another key character in the novel.
Great. And had you decided a lot on the plot before you started writing? Did you know where you were going to go with the story, or did you plan the characters beforehand? How much planning is involved, would you say?
Very little. I am very planned and organised in every area of my life, and it's to my immense surprise that I cannot be and organised when it comes to writing. My creativity seems to be stymied by any attempt to force it into a plan. And so really what I sit down to do when I write is to just write one page at a time. And the book almost unfolds for me in that manner, in the same way, I guess, that it does for a reader when they're reading the book. So all I knew when I sat down to write was that I wanted to write a character based around Lee Miller, and that was it. So then I had to work out who were the other characters, that what might appear in the book, what might happen to Jeff, what was kind of the dramatic tension that might keep readers propelling their way through the book, and then also how to work in a sort of a dual contemporary historical narrative. So my first drafts are very messy. I don't show them to anyone because it's really me working out what the story is, which means I do a lot of editing and a lot of rewriting to take that first draft and shape it once I know what the story is that I'm trying to tell.
So do you do your research as you go then?
I do a little bit of it when I write the first draft, but again, I try not to do too much research up front because then I find that you tend to write to what the research tells you is possible, which limits your imagination. So I really like, because I'm trying to figure out the plot in that first draft, I like to let my imagination run wild and imagine all kinds of different scenarios for my characters. So I'll generally read just a very broad book about the subject. So I read a book that talked about the experiences of a number of different female correspondents who worked during the Second World War. So that gave me a bit of background knowledge. And then, so that first draft is obviously full of gaps and holes where I need to do more research to kind of fill in the blanks. And then before I write the second draft, I spend a month or so doing a lot of research. I always travel to the places that I set my books in. I go to visit archives and libraries and museums, look through lots of documents and photographs, and in this case, reports and photographs from all the different correspondents, and read lots of books. And then I sit down to write that second draft with knowledge of what the story is and a really thorough knowledge of the topic and having researched it well.
Mm. And how about the dual stories then? Because part of the book is set in 1942 and then another part in 2005. Any particular reason you chose those times or 2005 particularly?
Mainly because I wanted to write a dual narrative. I'd written that for the first time in The Paris Seamstress, and my readers seemed to really enjoy that, and I really enjoyed the challenge of writing it, and so I wanted to try that again for The French Photographer. And you are kind of limited in a way as to how late that contemporary storyline might be based on the distance in time from the Second World War. If you want a character Second World War to still be alive in contemporary times, and you can't go, you know, kind of too far, or they will just simply be too old. So 2005 felt like about the right kind of timing to make that workable for what I had planned to do with the book. So it was really a bit of a logistical question in terms of deciding what exact year that would be. But I always knew that I wanted to write that contemporary storyline set in a French chateau, which meant that, of course, I had to go to France and stay in a French chateau in the Champagne region for a week in order to research the book very authentically.
Damn research!
I know.
Brilliant. Well, have you already planned your next book? Do you know what you're doing next, or do you have a break in between?
No, I don't have a break. In fact, I have a book coming out tomorrow in Australia, which will be the next book to come out in the UK and then also in various countries in Europe. It's called The Paris Secret. So it's coming out here in Australia tomorrow, but then I think it's not coming out in the UK until next year now with the current situation in the world. We've postponed publication of it over there, and it will be in various European territories over the next 12 months too.
Okay. The Paris Express, did you say?
The Paris Secret.
Oh, The Paris Secret, sorry. Paris
yes.
Secret. Great. Well, if people want to get a copy of The French Photographer, it is out now and available to buy on our website, tre.radio. It's by Natasha Lester, who we've been chatting to today. Natasha, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to me.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
This is TRE.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from Greece is Patricia Wilson, who was born in Liverpool, has lived on Crete and is now settled on Rhodes. She was first inspired to write when she unearthed a rusted machine gun in her garden, one used in the events that unfolded during World War II on the island of Crete. The now elderly woman involved in those events told Patricia their story, and her celebrated debut, Island of Secrets, was the result. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about her latest novel called Greek Island Escape. Welcome to the Book Show, Patricia.
Thank you, and hello, Hannah Murray. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's lovely to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. So tell me, how long have you lived in Greece for?
Well, over 25 years now.
Oh, how lovely. And what took you out there?
I was in my late 30s, and a workaholic. I've always been a workaholic. And a programme came on the TV in Britain called A Place in the Sun. And a tragic event happened and made me think about why I'm working so hard. So I made a plan to retire when I was 45. Now, that was old then. Believe me, I thought that was old. But when I was 45, I sold up and retired to Crete.
Oh, lovely. And had you been writing before then, or did you started writing when you were there?
No, absolutely not. I'm absolutely terribly dyslexic. So I got a computer when I retired. I bought a computer. And this magical thing, you know, to be able to put your thoughts down on paper. I'd never been able to do it before.
Such
a wonderful thing. I mean, it's what separates us from animals, you know, that we can actually record our thoughts is incredible. So I started writing short stories and poems and entering competitions and finding editors who would help me, who were sympathetic. And so I started writing. And then later on, of course, I discovered the machine gun, and when the women told me their stories that hadn't been told before to anybody, not even the families, they didn't know what these women had gone through. And it was what kept me awake at night.
I'm not surprised for discovering a machine gun in your garden. Just tell us a bit more about that. What happened?
Yes, it was amazing. I had bought an old cottage and refurbished it and moved into it and started on the garden. And I bought a couple of trays of strawberries to plant, you know, and I was digging, and my spade hit metal, and it was, I pulled it out, and I couldn't believe what I had in my hands. And I took it down to the Cafe Neon. That's the living room of the village, you know, in an old Greek village. They have this Cafe Neon thing, and it's where all the men go when the women want them out of the way.
I love that. What a great expression, the living room of the village.
It is, yes. I mean, the men collect the pension there, and they pay their electric bills there, and it's a community centre, really.
Mm.
So I took it down there, and one of the old men started talking to me. I speak some Greek, but he was speaking in the local dialect, and it's rather like trying to understand broad Scots. You know, it's very difficult if it's not your first language. And so other people came down, and it was siesta time. Other old people came down, and they all started talking to me at once. And then they brought me an old man, and it's so emotional. It still cuts me up to tell this, but they brought an old man, and he started talking to me, and he started crying. Well, it was so sad. And I discovered, if you read Island of Secrets, he was the doctor. He was the man who was left behind, you know, to tell the story of what happened. Well, they all wanted to tell me their story, and I started writing it all down. And about 3 months later, a very old woman came knocking on my door. She must have been late 80s, early 90s. There are no records of when people were born from that time, so I have to guess. But I got a translator, and she started telling me what happened to her. And I had a little recorder, so I pressed the recorder, and I recorded the thing she told me and took it to my Greek lesson so the Greek teacher could translate it for me. And I didn't get anywhere because the Greek teacher was in tears the whole time. So I had to give her the tape, and she wrote it down for me in English. And so that was how the story started. I decided then I had to write about women. I'm not, I'm not a staunch feminist, but it was such a story. And not many stories about women are told from the war, you know, about the actual tragic events. So I decided there and then that if I managed to write more than one book, then it would be about women and their struggle. And weak women that become stronger and conquer difficulties, which we do, don't we, I mean?
Definitely. And Island of Secrets, that book, did very well, sold over 150,000 copies.
Yes, and in 5 languages as well. Very pleased with that.
Wonderful. So your latest book, Greek Island Escape, is set in Crete, is that right? Or partly set in Crete?
Crete and Athens, yes. Yes, and that was another coincidence that started that book. When I came here, you know, I've lived here 25 years, as I said, and sometimes I love Greek food, but sometimes I just have this hankering for Sunday roast. Sprouts, roast potatoes, Yorkshires, you know, the whole kit. And there's one small Greek tavern here that did a Sunday roast on a Sunday afternoon. So I went down there and I told the guy I was writing a book because they want to know everything about you. It's lovely. That's a lovely friendship thing. And I told him and he said, I've got a story for you. And he told me this story about someone in his family. But first, I had to put my hand on my heart and swear I wouldn't say who it was because it's a famous person.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's somebody you know.
Ooh.
And so, a famous singer.
Okay.
So I swore, and so he told me this story. And I was blown away. I mean, I was blown away. And so I went to Athens and I walked the walk, as you do. I love to do that, you know, go everywhere that was in my story and take photographs. And then I researched. I love the research very, very much, the history, to make history so boring, isn't it? I mean, let's be honest. But to put it into a story and make it an entertainment, I think it does a job in that it gets the facts into people of what really happened at certain eras in our past or even in our early present lives. And so I did the research and I was absolutely staggered, and it led on to me looking into homeless people in Britain. And so so it went on about a mother searching for her child.
And
that's all I'm going to tell you about that.
Okay, fair enough.
Very moving, tearjerker with some laughs in there.
And there's two different stories, isn't there? There's a story that takes place in London and one in Crete.
Yes, the one about the singer in Athens who comes to Crete, and the one about the London magistrate whose daughter has run away.
And presumably the two stories intertwine at some point.
Yes, they do.
Mm-hmm.
They do, very much so.
Wow, yeah. Brilliant stuff. Well, I love Greece, so any book set in Greece, I'm right there. Spent quite a few years in Naxos particularly.
Oh, did you? I've been there, yes.
Mm.
Yes, it's beautiful.
A perfect setting for beautiful books and stories, isn't it?
Yes, yes, and not as commercial as some of the other islands like Mykonos and Santorini, you know, so that's very nice. I like that.
Yeah. Well, if people want to get a copy of Greek Island Escape, it's available to buy on our website in the bookshop section on tre.radio. It's by Patricia Wilson, who we've been chatting to today. Patricia, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you, Hannah. It's been a pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Mark Jarvis. He's been a primary school teacher for 26 years, and he's just published his debut novel, Ned and the Chocolate Cheats. It's based on Mark's real-life companion, his dog, Ned. Welcome to the book show, Mark.
Hi, pleased to be here.
That's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. So tell us a little bit about the background behind your book and your inspirational dog, Ned.
Well, as you say, Ned was the inspiration for the book, or indeed is the inspiration for the book. And Ned's been my companion for about 13 years. He's getting on a bit now, but he's still got lots of energy. But Ned and I spend a lot of time together, and we've been to most places in the UK and over to Northern Ireland. And I was thinking that when I had a chance to go abroad and couldn't take Ned with me, my mind was thinking, well, what would he say about this if he could speak? If Ned were able to speak, how could we share the experience together? What would we say? And these kind of idle thoughts I decided to put down on paper. And when the friend read them, they said, this is great, what's going to happen next?
Oh, yeah, it's a lovely thought, isn't it? If we could actually communicate with our pets, if they could really talk to us, all the things that they would say.
Indeed, it is, yeah. Sometimes people who own pets, I don't know if you own one, but people who have pets, I think they feel a kind of bond between them, like they're almost talking to you. And as I say in the book, it won't be long before, indeed, animals will speak to us, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. So what kind of a character is Ned, then, your Ned?
Well, my Ned is very much like the character in the book, to be honest. He's a very exuberant, excitable Jack Russell who's positive and excited about everything and wants to be involved with everything and knows about and plays and jumps and really enjoys getting stuck into everything. Doesn't get downhearted, or doesn't in the book anyway. And he's an ideal lead character to sort of drive the story forward.
So do you think there's going to be a series about Ned, or is this just a standalone book?
I have planned a series, and I'm writing the next one already, and I'm about three quarters of the way through. And my idea initially was it was going to be a sort of trilogy, and this book, Ned and the Chocolate Cheats, sort of finishes on a bit of a cliffhanger. It's a nice lead into the next story, so I'm hoping, well, in fact I know, because I've spoken to a few people who've children who have read it now. They're wanting to know what happens next.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it is good. So I'm hoping to give them that soon.
And this book is written for 9 to 11-year-olds. How did you decide the kind of age range that you're aiming the book at? Are they the age of the kids that you're teaching?
Yes, simply. They are the age that the children have to teach. So I wanted to write a story with them in mind, and I thought, what would they really like? What kind of things are they interested in? What do they talk to me about? And so I thought a book about animals and adventure and chocolate. And so what not to like, really?
Oh, definitely. So without giving too much away, can you tell us a little bit about what happens in the book?
Yeah, so it starts off, like all good adventures, at the safety of home, a little description of Ned's normal life. And a series of events takes him to explore, well, he goes up to London first and then finds himself having to take a flight to another country. And this leads him off around the world in the hunt for these chocolate cheats, these people who are attempting to steal all chocolate in Britain so that people are forced to eat their cheap chocolate substitute.
Oh no, that doesn't sound good at all.
Well, and Ned gets involved with MI5, who are also onto them, and it turns into a bit of espionage thriller chase around the world.
Oh, I love it. I was going to ask you about that, how MI5 come into the book.
Yes, as a character. I'm not spoiling it by saying who this character is. There's a character called the man behind the newspaper, who is the MI5 spy master, who gives Ned all his gadgets and the information he needs. And he's quite a nice character that appears in this book and the next one.
Mm.
And will continue to appear, really, because he's a nice driver for the story as well.
So how did you find the process of writing the book? Have you ever done anything like this before? Are you used to kind of creative writing with the teaching that you do?
Yeah, and the thing about creative writing with the teaching is that it's generally only for a short part. It's like the introduction to a story, or planning out the main parts of the story, or it's rarely sustained to write a whole book's worth. And that's the bit I found most difficult, really, because to write a book, this was 42,000 words, which isn't long by long book standards, but it was the longest I've certainly ever written. And to sustain that idea all the way through did pose a few challenges right at the beginning, but once I planned out where I wanted the story to go, it flowed, and it was quite really enjoyable to do.
So you did plan then, that helped you, did it?
Yes, I mean, not in minute detail, but generally the themes of where I wanted it to go and how it was going to end. Although as I approached the end, I had two or three different options in mind as to what I was going to do and which way it was going to go. So eventually the story led me to choose that option. It sort of developed to a point where that's the way it had to go.
Mm.
And I really enjoyed it. And so this book then leads on to the next one, and the adventure continues.
So how did you find the time to work to write the book when you were working full-time as well?
It took a number of years to write it, because I'm not the sort of person that can just dip in and out of something, just do half an hour here or there. I really had to sit down and get into the mindset of it, so a good couple of hours each time. So it was really only at weekends occasionally, or in school holidays. And this meant that as much as I would want to sit there and just write it and write it and let it flow, I couldn't physically do that. And that was a bit of a shame, really, because I kept having to stop and start and stop and start a little bit. But it developed over a number of years. But the good side of that was that as I went for a walk with Ned and wandered about, my mind was able to think about where I wanted to take the story next.
Mm. So it took a lot of dedication.
Yes, but it was something that I really enjoyed doing. So it wasn't a chore. Mm. It was real joy to do. And I did rather conceitedly laugh at some of my own jokes that I'd written in the book in the first part of the story when I read back. So I was pleased with how it was going.
Oh, that's good. And obviously Ned is coming back in future books. Are there other characters that go through into the new books?
There certainly are. There's the next door's cat called Gizmo, when the book is called Gizmo, and next door doesn't need to have a cat that sits on the wall and looks down at Ned. And the next door's cat is called Red, actually, because the children next door named him when they were very young. I'm not sure why they chose Red. But that's where the idea of Gizmo, the next door's cat. And Gizmo is very technologically minded and very good at computers and helps Ned out a lot. And Ned's person, Jeff, is also a main character in the book and is Ned's companion and follows him through, because as much as it's amazing to have a dog that can talk and they can take part in normal life, they still don't have hands. And I think you really do need the help of a human for this kind of life that we made for ourselves. So Jeff, whose nickname is Jeff, because his real name is Cornelius Jeffries. So at school, all his friends called him Jeff. And Jeff and Ned are great pals. And it's about the relationship between them two and the sort of arguing and the different characters of the pair. They sort of bounce off each other.
Great. Well, if people want to get a copy of Ned and the Chocolate Cheats, it's available to buy on our website, tre.radio. It's by Mark Jarvis, who we've been chatting to today. Mark, thank you very much for joining us and best of luck with the book.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.